Beis Hashem, this Shabbos, I won't be in Chutzlaretz. You'll be spending Shabbat in Tzfat. And it's a city that throughout the centuries has been associated with Kabbalah, or Jewish mysticism, starting, of course, with the affiliation between the city and Shulman Chai. Later on in the 16th century, the Yassin Cairo, and the Ariya Kadosh, two champions of Kabbalah, certainly the Ariya Kadosh. And then in recent times of Hasidus, which is based on Kabbalah. And I feel that sometimes we discover a couple years ago that just dropping a contingent of Gush boys into Tzfat, out of Gush and out of your background without giving a little bit of context and what it comes from, what it's based on, is a little bit foreign, a little bit artificial. And the goal for Shabbos and the goal for this year is not to turn you into the Kabbalah and the Hasidim. And there are other parts of Tzfat that hopefully you'll be exposed to, not just the Kabbalah angle, but Tzfat figures prominently in modern Zionist history, Tzfat figures prominently in Tanaitic history, having nothing to do with Kabbalah per se, and you'll be exposed to that also. Tzfat is a very layered, not just typographically, but it's very historically layered, but such a major pulse of Tzfat has been Kabbalah and Hasidus. What is Kabbalah? What is Hasidus? What is it based on? Probably look at me and see that I'm not a chassid, but I've done a lot of work with chassidus, I did a master's in chassidus, so this is just a outside view of chassidus, trying to make it something familiar to people that aren't practicing chassidim. You know, it's not just spooks and gooks, but it's something more intellectually founded, Kabbalah and chassidus together. So we'll start with Kabbalah. Chassidus is an adaptation of Kabbalah. Hopefully I'll give you a little bit of background, not just for tzfat, but that when you pass a chassid down the street who doesn't daven within Zman Tefillah, you won't ask yourself, what, is that person crazy? How can he miss Zman Tefillah? No, his Zman Tefillah is based on a whole different way to time, a whole different way to mark time. So we'll see what this is based on very soon. Okay. In religion, the challenge that haunts and that fuels religion is the distance between man and God. Much as I want to try to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is unknowable. God is impenetrable. God is inscrutable. In English it's called transcendent. In Hebrew it's called Kadosh. Kadosh means you can't know God. It doesn't mean he's holy. You can't know him. He's untenable. But yet I want to feel him. I want to love him. I want to reach out to him. I want to study his will. I want to engage in a relationship with him. How do you bridge the gap between a transcendent, infinite, unknowable God and mortal, limited, corporeal man? That's the challenge of every religion. Paganism humanizes God. Religion is meant to create a bond or an interface between humankind and God. God has to be more human. So that could be very, very gross forms of paganism. God is a season or a lake or a forest or a wind or a bear. It could be a little bit more sophisticated paganism. God is a planet. Planets interact with human beings. They dictate our seasons. They dictate our life cycle. They provide heat. They provide... So I could feel planetary influence. It could be a little bit more sophisticated, where the gods aren't planets, but gods are these ethereal beings living on Mount Olympus, but they act very human-like. Apollo's running off with Diana, and Zeus is making fun of Papa. Because they're very human, because I want to be able to identify with gods. If gods are human-like, then they have to behave like human beings. And Christianity, which is really the final form of paganism, where God is transcendent, God is unknowable, God himself is beyond. But you have to have some way to relate to God, to paint God, to feel God, to touch God, to scream at God, to celebrate with God. So God is beyond, but his son was physical, his son bled, his son was human. So it's the best of both worlds, like have your cake and eat it too. It's like a chilek, like Brisker paganism. One end, God himself, Tzvei. God removed, transcendent. His son, physical, flesh and blood, etc. And then Islam's really not paganism, it's probably a whole different brand. But we could call Catholicism, Christianity, the last form of paganism to visit there. So that's paganism in a nutshell, a very big nutshell, but a nutshell. Now, rational Judaism is based on transcendentalism. Essentially, I accept the distance between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and myself. That distance will never be bridged. I can try as best as I can to study his will, as it applies to my world, halacha, as it applies to my inner world, agadita, but I will never ever bridge God because my ration is simply incapable of bridging that distance. So I accept that distance, I accept the mystery. In the emotional world, it's called Yirat Shamayim. Yirat Shamayim means I know I'll never understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so therefore, I listen to his will even when I can't understand it, even when I can't understand why it makes sense I follow and I succumb to his will. But rational Yiddishkeit accepts distance. Mysticism says, we're going to bridge the distance. Mysticism says, how can I reach out to that infinite God and not know him because my intellect is simply incapable? That's tautological. That's formulaic. My intellect can't grasp God. That's built into religion. God is something other, unless you're a paganist. So my intellect can't understand God. So mysticism says, I'm going to try to bridge that distance, not through intellect, but through experience. What Aquinas, who spoke about mysticism in general, referred to as cognition de experimentalis. Cognition, knowing through experiment. There's no way that my ration can decode God. But my experience can, as the Pasuk says, ta'amu u'ru'u ki tov Hashem. I can taste HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I can't know him, but I can taste him. That's basically the goal of mysticism in any religion. And that's the goal of Jewish mysticism, which we could call, for lack of a better term, and all these terms are very general. I just want to give you a general overview, what we call Kabbalah. Kabbalah in general would be Jewish mysticism. Understanding, not through intellect, but trying to understand the parts of God that intellect can't get. So for example, if I look at the ocean, physics and science and oceanography and chemistry can tell me how the particles are bonded and the molecules are bonded and how the waves go and how the thermo pools of water shoot up from deep abysses in the sea. But there's a spiritual substrate. There's part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he created the world. The sea isn't just molecules and physics. There's something, there's a spiritual substrate that's holding it together that Hashem inserted into the world. Kabbalah would be described, let's say, as the interface between Maisa Bracious and Maisa Merkava. Or Maisa Bracious would be, again, these are also very loose terms, would be loosely called physics, how the world was created. And Maisa Merkava would be, yeah, but how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu continue to interact with that world and fuel that world and deliver that spiritual component to them? Well, I can't see that. I can look at this table 1,000 years and I can break it down with my spiritual experiments. There's parts of this table that my intellect just can't understand. There's parts of the cosmos that my intellect just can't understand. And I have to try to receive truths that are contained in those two books, Maisa Bracious and Maisa Merkava. That's the goal of Mekubal. That's the goal of Jewish mysticism. And believe it or not, as much as you really haven't been exposed to it, Kabbalah is as old as Torah itself. Kabbalah was delivered at Har Sinai through the Sefer HaZohar or the equivalent, and Yecheskel and Perek Aleph and Yecheskel and Perek Yud. You can read about his discussions of Maisa Bracious and Maisa Merkava. Maisa Merkava is called so because it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chariot, because it's the interface. Just like if I'm riding on a chariot, the chariot is the interface that takes me through a certain place. So the Merkava is, how does the Kodesh Baruch Hu interface with the physical world? Hashem is non-physical, Hashem is infinite, Hashem is removed. How do we explain the interface between the Kodesh Baruch Hu and the physical, empirical, concrete world? The Gemara in Chagiga, the Mishnah in Chagiga, talks about how you're not allowed to teach Maisa Bracious in front of too many people. You can only study Maisa Merkava B'yachid. So Chazal were very, very aware of Maisa Bracious, Maisa Merkava, and the person that codified, just like Vida Nasi codified, Maisa Halacha, Nigla, the world of Halacha, the Shisha, Sidre Mishnah. Can I ask everyone just to take off the hoods? It's nice and warm in here now, okay? It's just it's a nicer feel, okay? Just indulge me. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai codified the Kabbalah into what was called the Sefer HaZohar. But it was not Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai who made up the Sefer HaZohar. So, for example, the Mishnah in Chagiga, which I put down in the other sheets, I didn't get a sheet. Mishnah in Chagiga, when I didn't get a sheet. Arba Yechisu Lechardes. There are four people who started to study Chardes. Started to study Shah, Yanez, Drash, and so. And part of that is the world of Kabbalah, the mystical world. One of them was Ben Azai. One was Ben Zoma. One was Ker. One was Rabbi Akiva, source number one. Ben Azai, Hitzitz Umez. Ben Azai took a look at this world and he died. Ben Zoma, Hitzitz Venifka. Zigmara Megillah, Mishnah in Chagiga. Ben Zoma took a look and was Nifka. Basically, more or less he went crazy. He didn't die, but he went to sanity. Acher, Elisha Ben Avuya, Kitzitz Ben Atiyos. By being exposed to the world of Kabbalah, he became a heretic. He started uprooting the trees. Rabbi Akiva Yatzal B'Shalom. Rabbi Akiva was the only one of these four who made it out with his sanity intact, with his life intact, with his with his theology intact. And because of this Gemara, or this Gemara is a reflection, the study of Kabbalah was always esoteric. It was not meant to be Democrat. It was not meant to be shared by common. You want to learn, you learn the Hanigla. You learn the Halach of Zrayim. You learn the Halach of Karbanos. You learn the Halach of Bava Kama, how to write again. When it comes to understanding, not just physics, that would be my sabracious, biology, but metaphysics and the interface, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a transcendent God can express himself in our world, that's only something that special people study at a certain age in small groups, so that we can avoid the danger of the Gemara Kritika. And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was not the only Tana to write. Sifrei Kabbalah, Rabbi Yishmael, his contemporary, Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva, just like Yitzchok Mechilta or Nigla, Rabbi Yishmael also wrote a Sefer in Kabbalah. But throughout the centuries, it remains something esoteric. Now, two great figures in Jewish philosophy shifted the way. There are two great Jewish thinkers who were hyper-rationalists. And they basically, through great effort, they partially succeeded, rid the Jewish world of Kabbalistic influences, by and large, and certainly as a prominent and popular study. Who are these two people who had the greatest negative impact on Kabbalah? The Rambam? Before the Rambam? Sajagon. Sajagon was a 9th century Gaon. Major Sefer called, anyone know the Sefer Sajagon? Emunas Videos. Super rational, shouldn't study Kabbalah, and certainly you all know the Rambam's great legacy of anti-Kabbalistic influences. Problem is they failed. Most medieval authorities that we read every day, whose halacha we follow every day, were all mikubalim on the side. Not on the side meaning late at night when no one was watching, but along with their study of Nigla, they studied this other discipline. The Rashba was a mikubal, the Ramban was a mikubal, the Ravid was a mikubal. Basically, all the Rishonim, save a few, were strongly influenced by the Rambam, were also mikubalim, including Rabbi Yosef Karo. So every minute you practice halacha, you're practicing the halacha that a mekubal institutionalized. There's a sefer called Magid Meisharim about a certain visitation he had from a malach, and that malach told him all sorts of mishnayos that he then, or halachas that he then recorded. And in fact, much of Shulchan Aruch is Kabbalistic influence. Some people don't keep the parts of Shulchan Aruch that are Kabbalistic. So for example, I don't tie my shoes left, right, right, left, left, right, left, because that's pure Kabbalah. There's no basis in the Gemara for how to tie your shoes. And since I'm not a practicing Mekubal, if I would be, I would keep all of Kabbalah. I feel there's a problem, as we'll see later, of trying to pick your places. I want to keep Kabbalah here, so I don't tie my shoes in a certain way. Nitil Sadayim is also Negel Vaser, as we call it. It's very strongly influenced by Kabbalah. But the reason I keep Nitil Sadayim is because it's not pure Kabbalah. It also has halachic anchor. The reason you wash your hands is a Chana Fitzfilah, like we call it in the base of Mikdash. And in addition, there's a Kabbalistic element of Ruach Ra. So, for example, a lot of Haredim, you just heard a spokesman for Haredim, who are much more attuned to Kabbalah, even if they're not practicing the Kabbalah, you can go into a Haredi maternity ward and find parents washing Negel Vaser and Netil Sadayim on their one-day-old infant. He's Pater Mitzvah, there's no din of Chinuch. If you take Kabbalah literally, he slept the night before, he has Ruach Ra in his hands. If he puts his hands into his mouth, that's going to spread the Ruach Ra. But that's true. It's not a joke. This real, if you participate in the world of Kabbalah, then Ruach Ra is something you have to take seriously into account. I believe in the world of Kabbalah. That world exists. I choose not to operate in that world. I choose not to practice that world. I choose to use my logistics and my apparatus as a world of Nigla. But if I really felt that I was operating in the world of Kabbalah, then I'd be worried about a Ruach Ra. I don't wash my little infant's hands. I just wait till they're Higiyah L'chinah, when they're 3-4 years old, and they wash the Tehillah Sadayim in order. So if you ask the point was, I'll get to your question in a second, and please ask questions. Please don't laugh it away. Don't, you know, keep things to yourself. These are important questions to ask, so that going forward, not that you should be practicing the Kabbalah, but you shouldn't be people that ridicule the scoff at Kabbalah, Chas V'Shalom. This is part of our Masorah. So, Yosef Karo was in the Kabbalah, and Shulchan Aruch was influenced by Kabbalah. A lot of people that don't operate in the world of Kabbalah choose not to accept certain parts of Yosef. Mirtz Hashem, one day, for example, something that I heard today when Jonathan Rosenblatt was speaking, is if, you know, modern conventions of romance are very, very foreign from the way we're meant to conduct marriages, and I think that's true. There are large portions of the way modern romance and feminization and sexualization are presented in our media that I find very, very abrasive and very foreign. But the basic idea of romance, I buy into the basic idea that a person should choose a soulmate based on love and based on companionship and based on physical attraction, as I think Haredim do as well. But I certainly believe I think it was just our terminology is different. I certainly believe that modern ideas of romance are something which I should adopt. But if you take a look at the way Mekubalim describes sexual activity, there should be no romantic element. When the Ravid describes sexual activity, you should not be thinking about the physical attraction to your wife. You should be thinking about cosmological realities, which we'll talk about later, and people that are into Kabbalah today. And that's a legitimate, just because it's different from yours doesn't mean it's wrong. It's a legitimate way to proceed in your sexual encounter. And that's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch quotes that when you're involved in being Adam Le'ishto, you should be thinking about certain machshavos. If you look in the end of Aruch Chaim, most people my type don't keep, you know, specifically those halachas, because they're not really based on Chazal, they're based on Kabbalah. Anyway, so that's just a general, the evolution of Kabbalah. We're now at, I'll answer your question in 10 seconds, we're now at a very important watershed moment, the repopularization of Kabbalah in the 16th century by someone who lived in Tzfat named Reb Yitzchak Luria, otherwise known as the Reb Yaakov. So that's where we are right now. That's why we're discussing Kabbalah, and then we'll segue into Hasidus. Eitan.
You mentioned at the beginning of this year that mysticism was originally the pathway for man to not really understand intellectually, but to understand God through the experiential pathway, so to speak. All these things that are in the Shulchan Aruch and that are Kabbalah passed down, if people don't understand them, if people don't see how they would show us God experientially, what's the point of that?
Okay, good question. An even stronger question when we get to Hasidus, because Hasidus attempts to diffuse Kabbalah across, you know, a mass of modern, uneducated man. But the point is, I will use the Shulchan Aruch as my Kabbalah filter. Anything of Yosef Kaira, who predicated the Shulchan Aruch on a rational foundation, chose to incorporate, that then becomes transformed into part of the system. So for me to go back and find something in some strange 13th century Kabbalistic Sefer and introduce it, maybe not. But if I'm just using the Shulchan Aruch as my baseline, and keeping everything, as I'm relying solely on Yosef Kaira's worldview, which was, let's say, 90% of the Shulchan Aruch, 95% is rational, and there's a 5% Kabbalistic influence. And I'm taking how he thought that blend should occur, even if I'm not able to understand it.
Okay. It seems to be a personal matter. It seems to be
not
like
necessarily.
Your own experiential.
It's personal. It's personal, but it doesn't have to be self-mediated or self-understood. And that's what Hasidus does. You don't have to understand the deeper metaphysics or the deeper spiritual stuff. You just have to know that by washing your hands this way, you're removing Ruach HaEitan. Or by engaging Benish Lishto in this way, you're creating Tikkunim in Olam HaZeh. And trust me that you are. You don't have to go through the intellectual gymnastics to try to understand it. And that's what Yosef Kaira, it's a very good point, Anthony. I've never thought of it this way. Basically, it's a precursor to Hasidus, because that's what Hasidus is going to do in large measure by trying to introduce all of Kabbalah to an uneducated mass. Yes?
The different halachot in the Shulchan Aruch, which say have no rational basis or no foundation.
I say no rational, no basis in Nigla in halacha in Gemara, yes.
Yeah. So those, from the perspective of Kabbalists today, legitimate Kabbalists today, would they say that by one not keeping those halachot on that basis, that's like illegitimate? Or
if you're practicing Mekubal, and I don't think.
I understand, yeah. But would they say that people aren't practicing Mekubal? Like, would they say that they're picking and choosing?
I don't think so. I don't think so. This is a good opportunity for me to state what I think is probably the thesis of tonight's year. What I want you to walk out of here is the following balanced approach to Kabbalah. A, it exists. It was always exist. It was given in Har Sinai. B, you don't have to practice it in order to be a complete Jew. C, person is a Mekubal is not hierarchically higher than the person. We think, he's the Mekubal. Let's listen to his authority. So, for example, I never plan on being a Mekubal. I know that it exists, but I can spend 1,000 lifetimes and still not exhaust all my efforts in the world of Nigla. So I've chosen in my life to put all my efforts into the world of Nigla. And if Hashem told me, when I finish living this life, you can live another life and continue another X amount of years, okay, I want to learn more Gemara. I want to learn more Halacha. I want to think about more philosophy. Kabbalah is a parallel way for me to try to understand Hashem. It's not superior. It's when you've exhausted Nigla. For each person, that's a different level. But it has to be a certain point of exhausting Nigla. You feel you want to participate in this world, then you have to be consistent. You can't be a Mekubal like Madonna. I'll just drink the water and put on the red band. But then you have another, but it's not superior. So for example, I'm not a Mekubal. But there have been times in my life when there have been illnesses in the family, not too many times, but I feel totally comfortable. Let's say you came to me with an illness that all the doctors couldn't heal and all the tefillahs couldn't solve. I'd say, go to a Mekubal. because there's no question that there may be solutions to your illness that aren't captured by the medical world, that aren't captured by the halachic world, that have to deal with the spiritual substrate of that illness. How come that illness is afflicting you? So you don't have to be a makubal and say, okay, at this point the world of Nigla doesn't offer me any answers. It's not a vodazar. It's not spooks and gooks. So they take stones or they take birds or whatever they're doing. It's not crazy witchcraft. It's just something we don't choose to participate in. And just because that person has a solution that we can't achieve doesn't mean they're higher. It just means it's parallel. It's a specialty. But it doesn't make it superior.
Yeah, I understand that. That's from our perspective. I'm saying from their perspective.
I think so. They're just choosing. You and I have limited resources. We choose to express our limited resources in the world of Nigla. And Mukubal says, with whatever limited resources I have, I'm going to stretch them into the world of Kabbalah. Okay? Yeah, dear.
Those deen based in Kabbalah that are codified by the Shulchan Aruch, why can we choose to ignore them on the basis that we're not practicing the Kabbalah? You know, we're all practicing halachic.
Okay, because there are other halachas that the Shulchan Aruch writes that are based on Nigla that we don't accept, because the Shach disagrees and the Taz disagrees, and in Bar Park they've got one Masara of which times they agree to disagree with the Shulchan Aruch, and in Alon Shemot they've got a different Masara, and the Rav had a Masara. It's not like every single word that Yosef Kaira wrote, every single Jew keeps to every single detail. So in certain areas a Masara developed that this we don't keep. I remember when I was learning Hilchos Nida, so I went over to my Rebbe and why you were willing, and he said, you know, in this case we hold like the Shach, in this case. And I'm sure if I went to Barra Park, there'd be a different Masara, and if I went to Muncie, there'd be a third Masara. That's why you have to find a Masara and stick to it. And you know, by and large, the Masara that you're all part of is of Gush, and why you type Rebbeya, you know, that aren't going to be gone in our world. And by and large, I'm sure you can ask JJ's father, and more or less, if we sat down and discussed Hilchos Nida, we never ever discussed Hilchos Nida, there'd be a 95% overlap, because more or less, we were trained in the same general Hashkafa. And then there are different Hashkafas and different Masaras. So it's not like every single word in the Shulchan Aruch we keep. It's a question of, I asked my Rebbe when I was in Yeshiva, do we keep this part of the Shulchan Aruch? And I was told no, so therefore I didn't keep it. Okay? Now, what happens after the Ri HaKadosh? The Ri HaKadosh of Yitzchak Luria changes Kabbalah, popularizes it, reestablishes the popularity in Tzfat, but it still remains esoteric, and it still remains, Eitan, very, very intellectual. To be a Mekumbal in the 16th century, you have to have a mind that follows the sophistication and the ins and outs and the formulas and the cosmological import of every action that you really, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, that Mekumbalim are very interested not just in our world, but in the larger cosmos. Everything that I'm doing, if I make a bracha the right way, you can't imagine the ricochet effect that will be felt 3 million light years away, where worlds, not just in the galaxies that are material, but even in upper worlds and upper spheres will be impacted. But it remains esoteric, it remains sophisticated, it remains something people study. And even to the days of the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon was a tremendous makub. He was someone who had such unlimited resources that he could both excel in the world of Nigla as well as excel in the world of Nistar. And many of his talmidim wrote Svarim and Kabbalah based on the Vilna Gaon's input. And those of you who have read Nefesh HaChaim, the Vilna Gaon's star Talmud, Chaim Balazhin, who started the Balazhin Yeshiva, was referenced earlier today. We'll see a lot of Kabbalah. All of a sudden, Hasidus comes on the scene. Now, we'll talk about how Hasidus emerges socially, historically, but Hasidus is premised on Kabbalah. Hasidus' goal is to create a revolution. It's a revolutionary movement, but to reintroduce Kabbalah, and here's the rub. Hasidus is a revolution trying to create meaning in religion for uneducated people. What happens is let me give you a little bit of historical background, okay? This maybe is necessary to appreciate the challenge that Hasidus faces by pitching itself on Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, but in trying to accomplish its social agenda. One of the hardest periods in Jewish history is the late 17th century, early 18th century. There's a confluence of factors that makes life miserable for Jews. The most important factor, Shabtai Tzvi, 1666, announces he's a Mashiach, raises hopes, at least one-third of the Jewish world believed him, sold off their possessions, moved to Israel, various degrees of moving to Israel, and then he converts 2 years later to Islam, to become a Muslim, and some people's hopes are completely dashed, and there's nothing more dangerous than dashed Messianic expectations, because you go backwards, you say, well, it'll never come, it'll never happen. To make matters worse, the fires keep raging. There are aftershocks and after tremors because Sabbateanism doesn't die down. There are all sorts of splinter movements, the Frankist movement, other types of movement, infighting, struggle, governments get involved. The Frankists had the Polish government on their side. Jews who opposed the Frankists were thrown in jail. Some of you know about the famous debates and the famous animosity, as it were, between the Yonis and Eibishitz and the Chacham Tzvi. And everyone thought the Yonis and Eibishitz was a Sabbateanist, and he may well have been a Sabbateanist, or just didn't fall for some of the excesses of Sabbateanism. A really, really terrible time. Terrible time to be a Jew. On top of that, the Polish Empire is about to crumble. It's losing its influence, especially in the eastern regions of its province, what is today the Baltic states, and it used to be the entire Polish Empire, and now the Polish Empire is losing. And when these political shifts occur, and there are economic strains, and there's cross-border fighting, who gets caught in the battle? Who was always victimized? The Jews. So the Jews were seen as the enemies of the Polish regime, and they're seen as the enemies of the enemies, and they're seen as rebels, and the Jews are constantly being pogromed. Economic situation is a disaster. Jews are really, really poor. There was something that was referenced earlier today known as the Va'ad Arba Aratzos. Anyone here of the Va'ad Arba Aratzos? The council of the four lands in which Jews lived, and they met every once in a while to try to institute takanos, some semblance of autonomy. That totally collapsed. What else was happening? And there was a distance and an alienation between the rabbinate and the common folk. Many of the rabbis were hired by the Polish government, so there were a lot of bribes involved. The rabbis became very involved in their own sophistication, their shiurim and more to show everyone how bright they were, how brilliant they were, what great tradition they could come up with, rather than trying to teach people at their level. And there's this widening gap between the leadership and the laymen, and there's a disillusionment, there's a dispiriting. Basically, the Jewish world is in very, very dire straits. And into this vacuum steps the Hasidic movement. And the Hasidic movement agenda is to try to offer meaningful religious experience for people who aren't able to learn in yeshivas, who aren't able to keep up with the sophisticated shiur the Rebbe's giving in Masechtas Gittin or whatever is being held. And you'd be surprised, and I'll talk about this a little bit in the end, how many influences of modern day Judaism can be traced back to Hasidus. Sound familiar? How do we create meaningful religious experience? Because in 1720, if you didn't learn Torah, you were not thought to be a meaningful, serious, passionate Jew. If you're learning, you're serious. If not, then you're just a nachshlapper. You're just a nothing. And Hasidus tries to revolutionize the Jewish community and make meaning for people even if they're not studying Torah. But what's the meaning for people if you're not studying Torah? You're affecting Kabbalah. You're affecting the worlds. You're affecting the larger equation. You're affecting, because listen to what I'm about to say, because this is important, I didn't say before. Kabbalah is not just about Eitan studying that gap and understanding. It's also about affecting the cosmos. What I mean is as follows. In Kabbalah, in any mysticism, but certainly in Jewish mysticism, division is bad. Unity is good. God is unified. Our world is divided. There's nothing in this world, nothing that you can see in our world that can't be divided. This paper could be divided into molecules. Your personality divided to ration, conscious, subconscious. Everything is divisible. God tried to create a world. I'll take the word tried in quotation marks. But in the creation of the world, tragedy occurred. Because God's essence went from being unified to being divided. And the way that we're going to redeem our world is by reunifying that cosmos. Is by creating yichud from division. And a mekubal is not just someone that studies the cosmos, but someone that affects the cosmos through his thought, through his action, and it could be non-rational action. How am I going to take the world from a state of division to a greater state of unity? That's going to redeem the world. Redemption for a mekubal is not just national and historical, it's cosmological. How am I going to take a universe that's apart? Danya Budi and I are not part of the same matter right now. We're separate. And this table is not the same. How are we going to take that world in it? All of this has Hashem's spirit in it because Hashem created it. So Hashem's spirit is divided. How are we going to take Hashem's spirit and unify it? Now, before Hasidus, that meant understanding the world, understanding the cosmos, understanding the relationship between Hashem and our world. I'm going to introduce a very important term right now to you. It's called Sviros. Sviros is one way to describe the interface between the infinite Hashem and a material world. Hashem is infinite, non-physical. How does that infinite non-physical essence become translated down into a physical world. Those are called seven spheres. If Hashem is, let's say, in the middle, let's say, seven spheres around Hashem, and by the time you get to the most external sphere, then you have our world. Those seven spheres, or spherot, are based on the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. Lecha Hashem, Hagdula, V'Hagvura, V'Hatiferes, V'Hanetzach, V'Ahod, and the two more that aren't mentioned in the pasuk. Chesed and Kolashmai Mavavitz. Hashem is called. And which mitzvah lends itself perfectly to the seven spheros, seven by seven?
Spheros
Omer. A seven by seven matrix. When I count spheros Omer, I don't say chesed shebe tiferes. I don't say nesach shebe hod, because I'm not a mekubal. I'm not going to say things. I don't want to turn Kabbalah into something artificial. I'm a mekubal, I would say it. I'm not a mekubal, so I don't just say things that are not meaningful in my life. So I'm not a practicing mekubal. Yes, sir.
Why, you mean, just a couple times now that you're not a practicing mekubal, so...
It goes back partially to Eitan's question, you know, why do we keep some parts of the Shulchan Aruch? Because I feel that you're turning Judaism into something magical and mechanical rather than understanding it. I'm very concerned that. Because if I knew how every Kabbalistic button would affect it, so I would know exactly what I'm doing. Rather than for people that are not in the Kabbalah, it's just religion, it appears magic, and just do this and this will happen, pull this lever and this will happen. If you're a Mekubal, you know what's going to happen. If I'm just going to parrot things, then religion, you're going to take yourself out of religion. You want to be religious, be moral, study Torah, you know, serve in the army, you know, whatever it takes for us to be from. And it can repaint religion in a certain way that would just seem like, as some people see it. And some people, I think this impression of a magical, mechanical religion is very, very prevalent in people who, for example, a lot of Sephardim who have more Kabbalistic influences. For them, religion tends to be, and I think it's just, it's what I'm looking for. It trivializes, and it empties religion of personal content. That's why I think it's very dangerous. And most people feel that way, yes?
I'm playing the devil's advocate a bit, but in order to make a parallel between that and Kirill, yeah, someone who doesn't really understand what Shabbos is about, I don't know what I'm required to do, but I know a couple of things. So isn't it the same as saying to them that you don't know, unless you know?
Okay. Let's leave the Kirov out, because that's a whole different Pandora's box, whether you can take artificial means and Kirov, you know, should you try to do a Kirov on based on Bible codes. Let's hold off on the Kirov, because there's a lot. Let me just try to translate this into what Hasidus did. Okay, so now Hasidus has to try to do the following. How are you, Thomas Cohn, as a Hasid, going to be involved in cosmic unification? I can barely string together a line. I mean, I'm having a hard time with Tosis and Gittin. You expect me to be a Mekubal? So Hasidus says, Eitan, you don't have to understand what you're doing. Just know that you're doing it. So just know, for example, okay, this is early Hasidus. When you daven, okay, let's say the next word in davening is the word la'am. Let's pick the word out of a chumash. You see the lamed? You see the ayin? You see the mem? You see how those three letters are merging to create one word? Lamed, aleph, mem? As you watch those letters merge, you should be thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's spirit in the cosmos merging into one. And if you think about it hard enough, then that will lend to cosmic unification. So in the 16th century, if you're a Mekubal, you have to learn Nusach Ari, read the Siddur, change your style of davening, and see how each word reflects a certain cosmic element that's meant to be merged. But if you're a Chassid in the 18th century, just read the word La'am, and just know that you're merging too, just like the letters are merging. If you're a Chassid in the 18th century, preface every mitzvah you do by an awareness of L'shem, Yichud, Kutcha, Brichu, Ushchin. Does anyone ever say that? You all say it once a year. When do you say it? You say it by every mitzvah. You don't have to know how you're unifying. The Noda Behuda in 1801 writes a scathing opposition. He doesn't want any of his Talmidim saying L'shem Yichud Kutcha Brichu. For this very reason, Adir, because you're not a Mekubal. You shouldn't be saying L'shem Yichud Kutcha Brichu. That's for Mekubalim. Chassidus promulgates L'shem Yichud Kutcha Brichu. If you look in many Sidurim before Sfiras HaOmer, it says L'shem Yichud Kutcha Brichu. I won't say that, because I'm not a practicing Mekubal. I would expect a Mekubal to say it, or a Chassid to say it. So, Eitan and Adir Kavona for Yichud becomes the stand-in for actual sophisticated personal understanding of how the Kippur Olam is wrapping. I just have kavana that the letters are merging. I have kavana, one second, that when I'm reciting this pasuk, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina will be merged. I have kavana, listen carefully, here's another chassidic change. I have kavana that every action that I'm doing, my Rebbe will tell me how that action will create unification. When I'm eating, I'm creating unification. When I'm shechting, I'm creating unification. Eating, non-religious activities become tools for cosmic unification, which is why Hasidus becomes so pedantic about Shechita. Because for me and you, I don't care what kavanas you had during Shechita. For me and you, I just want to know one thing. Did you do a good Shechita? Was the animal shechted halachically? But I'm a chassid, when I eat that meat, I'm trying to think how this eating of the meat is taking Hashem's spirit, which is vested in all divided parts of my cosmos, and making it one. So I have to make sure I'm eating a meat that a chassidish shochei put that capacity into. I'm going to a mikvah that a chassidish mikvah filler had kavana, so that my action of dipping in the mikvah, one second, Donnie, will create that unification. And the third part, and then I'll answer your questions, the third part for a chassid is not just kavana, and not just non-religious actions that can participate in unification, but tefillah becomes the centerpiece of Hasidus. It replaces Talmud Torah. That's why the Vilna Gaon was so opposed to it. And here's where I get to the Zman Tefillah. If I'm a Litvak and I'm davening in Vilna, so I'm davening Zman Tefillah because my tefillah is made of Bakashos, Shevach, Rachamim, Oz Yashir, Kabbal Zbach Shemayim. I make sure I daven within this Zman that's appropriate. If I'm a chassid, my tefillah isn't just being makala malchus shemayim. My tefillah is accepting cosmic realities. My tefillah is unifying the cosmos. You're going to tell me I have to daven before 9:30? What is it? 9:30 on Venus now? Is it 9:30 in some galaxy 4 million light years away? What do you care about some my tefillahs? I'm not davening in Vilna. I'm standing in some far Milky Way, some far, who knows where, which planet I'm standing. I'm involved in some cosmological reality. You can tell me I've been having it before 11 o'clock. What are you, crazy? And that's why Chassidus becomes much more flexible with Zman Tefillah. Because Tefillah is not a halakhic experience. It is a mystical, cosmological experience that transcends time and place. So I disagree with it because you can't play around with halakha. But a Mekubal may have the ability to say, even though Halacha says one thing, the Kabbalistic influence will change the guidelines of Halacha. I don't agree with it, but I just want you to know what it's based on. I'm sure Mekubal could explain with greater composure, could explain it to you better. But it's not based on, oh, let's daven whatever we want or whenever we feel like it. Based on the fact that Tefillah gets a whole new dimension. Those are three of the methods which Chassidus adopts to try to empower your average, regular, personal yid with the ability to create cosmic unification. You don't have to do it, just imagine it. You don't have to do it, just have kavana. You don't have to do it, just think of the letters, think of the tefillah, think of the meat, think of how every action you're doing is leading to ichud olamos. Daniel, one second, Ellie, one second, with two exceptions. One exception, the one branch of Hasidus which always remains very, very intellectual, and the Hasidim are meant to understand, not just to practice. Anyone know?
Lubavitch.
Lubavitch Hasidus geographically emerges in the backyard of the Vilna Gaon. Rav Shneur Zalman, the first Hasidish Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, lived in Vilna, and he would never accept, or Vilna would never accept, the Hasidus that wasn't based on the Talmud Torah. So number one, Talmud Torah was always prioritized, even though in the original generations of Hasidus, many did not know how to learn, even Rebbeim. But in Lubavitch land, everyone learned. The original Lubavitcher Rebbe was one of the biggest Talmid Chachamim of his generation, Rav Shneur Zalman of Lodi, and we still use the Svarim even if we're not Hasidim, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. And fascinatingly so, what happened was, listen to this, you want to see something fascinating and modern? You know those spheres we talked about, those cosmic spheres of Hashem's expression? Hashem is infinite and He expresses Himself through cosmic spheres? So listen carefully, guys, okay? If you're a real Mekubal in the days of the Ari, you have to study those spheres. What does Netzach mean? What does Hog mean? If you're a chassid, not a Lubavitcher chassid, you don't have to study those spheres, you just have to know that I'm unifying those spheres. If you're a Lubavitcher chassid, you know how you get to those spheres? It's fascinating. Every part of the human psyche corresponds to one of those spheres. So if you understand your psyche that well, you'll get to those spheres. It's very psychological. Chabad Chassidus is very, very psychological. So what does Chabad stand for? Chachma Bina Vadas. Three different ways of understanding. Whatever they mean. Each one of those are internal. Those aren't spheres. Those are internal to you. Chachma Bina Vadas. But your Chachma corresponds to the following sphere of Hashem. Your Bina corresponds to the following sphere of Hashem. Because it has to. Because your internal world has to correspond to the cosmological world. So all you have to do is make yourself into a better person, more unified, and then correspondingly the spheres will be unified. And then there's a major change that happens, and Janine, I want to answer your question, but and Ellie, I have to make sure you understand this in this context. Then all of a sudden, there's a third generation Hasidic Rebbe that does something amazing, provocative, and to many people, a big, big turnoff. Let me give you a little bit of an interaction, a little bit of an introduction. Who's the first Hasidic Rebbe? Who's the founder of Hasidus? Baal Shem Tov. When did Baal Shem Tov live? Okay, early part 1680, 1690. Passes away. Let me go to my notes because I'm not that much familiar. But he passes away in. Excuse me. Okay. He passes away 1760 on Shavuos. Good day to pass away if you're creating a legend about yourself. 1760, Baal Shem Tov passes away on Shavuos. He's named the Baal Shem Tov. Why? Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, it wasn't his last name, because he would hand out amulets. He would hand out names of Hashem, Shem Tov, to heal people. Hasidus Rebbeim would hand out amulets and whisper name of Hashem, which you can imagine really elicited a lot of opposition amongst people. They would go through the countryside and roam through the countryside and try to heal people through these Kabbalistic manners. When he passes away in 1760, his Talmud, Baruch Ber of Meshritz, the Magid Meshritz, takes over, and he stewards Hasidus as Hasidus becomes a movement. What does it mean it becomes a movement? Now all of a sudden it's not just the Baal Shem Tov going through the countryside trying to convert people, but people see themselves as belonging to a movement larger. Oh, I live in Poland, you live in Hungary, but we're both Hasidim. What does it mean we're both Hasidim? We're both Davin Nesachari. Not Nesachari, excuse me, a pigeon Nesachari. What's a pigeon Nesachari? What a Hasidim introduce? Nesach Svard. Svard is a Hasidic introduction. The Ari came up with his whole Nesach with all these fancy Kabbalistic triggers, and Hasidus is almost like a watering down of Nesachari. Nesach Svard begins in the 18th century under the Rebaruch Ber, the Magid Meshritz, Baal Shem Tov's Talmud. The concept of a chassid, and instead of the Rebbe going to Hasidim and visiting towns each Shabbos and each week and teaching Hasidus, but now people come to the Rebbe, Shalosh Regalim, to be in the Rebbe's chatzer. What else? There's a group of 300 Hasidim in 1777 who migrate from Poland to Eretz Yisrael. And which city do you think they go to? 1777, the first modern day Aliyah, Tzfat. They all go to Tzfat. So this is where Tzfat becomes a Hasidic town, and it becomes a town of Kabbalah. So 1777, they're moving together. Of course, the Cherem, the opposition to Hasidus, is 1772, the first Cherem. 1798, Lubavitcher Rebbe is thrown in jail. So part of being a movement is this opposition to your movement. You know, oh, we're against those guys, they're against us. Okay? Now, the third generation, I'm skipping over someone named Yaakov Yosef, who wrote the Bible of Hasidus called Toldos, but that's very hard to read. Third generation, who's going to Poland here, show of hands, you'll visit his grave in Luzansk, a small town. His name was Noam, Noam Elimelech of Luzansk. And he writes the first easy-to-read Sefer of Hasidus, known as the Noam Elimelech. He's referred to as many Hasidic Rebbeim, referred to as the Noam, the Noam Elimelech. I'll answer your questions in a moment, but what he does is, he says, look, it's too hard, listen carefully, this is really important to understand about Hasidus, it's too hard for the average Hasid on the street to read about Hasidus, to certainly be a Mekubal, to read about Kabbalah, to understand those spheres, to try to delve into that spiritual substrate. And it's even too hard for them to imagine, like my predecessors imagining that the letters are unifying, and therefore, in place of the spheres, are you ready now? In place of the spheres, I'm going to tell them to see them, to imagine spheres they can't see. Even if they don't have to understand what those spheres are, they're going to have to imagine a spiritual substrate. Even Grishkas have a hard time imagining it. I'll replace the spheres. Instead of trying to get to Hashem through his spheres, get to Hashem through something you can see. That's going to replace the spheres. The conduit between Hashem and this world. What's the conduit? Not those spheres? Me. It's up. And if you just hold on to me, if you just listen carefully, this is not crazy, it's not us. If you eat my food that I touch, if you listen to me, if you give money to me, to my chassid, so that you're not giving money to me, you're giving money to the Merkava of Hashem. Well, me, you can understand. And the tzaddik gets in the Ramah Limelech's world. And this is something, if you were here on Chanukah, we have a natural message every time to speak. We have a message every time to speak just a few days from now. And some people say it's avodah. It's not meant to be avodah zara. It can certainly bleed into avodah zara. But the Hasidic Rebbeim were not holding themselves up as idols. They were holding themselves up based on Midrashim, based on Sukkim. The notion of the tzaddik. This is called in the Noam El Melech, the doctrine of the tzaddik. You can read books about this. The doctrine of the tzaddik. He replaces the spheres of God in order to channel Hashem's presence to this world, to the average person. So it's not based on Mishigas, it's not based on Arishkai. It may not be our cup of tea, it may not be our way of practicing. It could be something that stands in between God and a human being, and we don't go for that, but it's based on very, very deep ideas which are anchored in Midrashim, depending on how you read those Midrashim. And that's how Hasidus pulls off the impossible. Taking Kabbalah and using Kabbalah as the source for a common movement of the common man to democratize religion. If you would have told Yitzchak Luria in the 16th century that Kabbalah one day will be the fuel for a democracy movement of Hasidus, he would have laughed at you. Kabbalah? That's only for Shimba Yochai. That's only for, you know, a few people. That's only for the greats. That's only for the esoterics, the elites. One day, there's going to be a movement that's founded on Kabbalah that will sweep millions of people. He would have laughed at you. That's the struggle of Hasidus. The pitch that Avodas Hashem on Kabbalistic, cosmological ideas made simple for the common man. Ali and Daniel. As what? It's not God. Remember, God always remains impervious, Ein Sof. But his sphere is God is faced with a problem. This is any classic mysticism. This isn't Kabbalah. God is faced with a problem. How do I go from being transcendent to immanent? How do I go, God asks himself, from being removed and you know, not part of our world to being immanent? So, in order to create a world, you have to pour Hashem to pour spirit in. So by pouring his spirit into a divided world, Hashem's spirit is going to become divided. That's called in Kabbalah the breaking of the vessels. And as the world, essentially in Kabbalah, listen carefully, there's a fall before the fall. If you're not a Kabbalah, when did the fall of man occur for us? When Adam and Chava sinned, and they fell into Chait. But according to Kabbalah, there's a pre-fall when the world is created. It's not a moral fall, it's a cosmological fall. Fall from a state of unity into a state of division. And part of redemption is not just a moral recovery, but a cosmological recovery. It's not something that your ration can understand. You just have to accept by the Masara that Hashem's presence can filter down through these spheres, and as it filters down, it separates, and redemption is put them together. I'm not a Mekubal, so I can't tell you the terminology, but I can tell you that it's not molecules, and it's not something that the empirical world is going to reflect. It's something that you're going to have to see and imagine in the empirical world. Yes, Daniel.
Would you say that an idea of people having to, you mentioned with the Hasidim, like for instance, the street, the, like, the guy does it because he feels that if the guy does, is it, first of all, is it true that Hasidim means that Hasidim should have? I heard that once. I always thought it was a form of shkita.
No, it started that way. It was also a form of shkita because they wanted to control it. So they developed a special shkita knife so that only Hasidim would have that knife. Remember, by the way, Daniel, from a political standpoint, a sociological standpoint, it's also why they were opposed to Hasidim, which is big money in shkita. So the Hasidim were moving on to people's territory. It wasn't just ideological, it was also mafia wars. But anyway.
Would you say that
the
Hasidim still believe that?
I don't know. But in those days, it was very, very clear that when you're pulling the knife across the animal's neck, you have to have the right kavanos, so that the guy down the food chain, literally eating, will be able to unify which Baruch is present by eating that meat. If you eat the meat of the Moshe Feinstein Shrita, it's meaningless, from a cosmological standpoint, even though it's shechted properly. This is another one order. Back here.
If you believe that that, well, it's true, and that it has the power to unify whatever. Well, it gives you the right to say, but I'm not a Mikubal, so I'm not going to work towards that redemption.
Because I believe that my power is also creating that, but not in a direct way. I feel that I'm going to hit redemption. My logistics for redemption is more Kedushas in this world, and more Torah, and more Mitzvot, and more Adazan, and so on. And then when redemption comes, that whole world is going to be unified. I don't have to be involved in the nuts and bolts of the cause of cosmic unification. Okay, that's what if you look at Chaim Volozhiner, he's basically, really simple, he's basically saying, all you have to do is learn Torah. I said, I will accomplish the same thing. So go out and learn Torah and focus on Tosfos all day. I know that every bit of Tosfos that I'm learning is going to create unity, but I shouldn't be bothered by that. I shouldn't think about that because it's going to distract me from Torah. And I'm sitting, I'm working over a telescope. Should I be thinking about planets and cosmos and things I can't see? They're thinking about logic in the back of my mind. No, I'm asleep. So if you ask me, do I think that I'm involved in cosmic unification? Of course I am. But you know the only way I can be involved in cosmic unification? I completely ignore it. Because if I think about it, I won't be able to do it. Whereas the Mikubal says, no, I'm going to tackle that process head on. I'm going to look at imagine opening up this big clock tower, and how the bolts move, and how the cards move, and how I'm going to try to move them faster. So I'm going to say, no, I'm just going to make sure that everyone looks at the clock, and then the clock will be more successful. Okay? So that's how I have the excuse not to practice Kabbalah, even though I know it's true.
Nowadays, we can't go anywhere in Israel without seeing a poster proclaiming the Rebbe is the Mashiach, or Nachum Uman. Do we sort of like view this idea of the tzaddik and giving all this glory? Shouldn't you view it as very dangerous?
Of course, of course it is, and that's why many people are opposed to it. But it was never hatched to be that. Although you could claim it shouldn't have been stated because it courts that. And in terms of a short little summary, Nachman is not heresy. You know, anyone who believes that he's still alive is not heresy, and maybe Mishagas, but it's not. Because if you feel, if a Lubavitcher person will say the Rebbe was a Mashiach, if you ask me, that's Narishkeit. But it's not a theological heresy. If a Lubavitch person says, I daven to the Rebbe, I pray to the Rebbe, I say Kaddish to the Rebbe, that's heresy. You can't eat that person's sleep. And there are very few of those. There are a lot of messiness. There are very few people that believe the Rebbe is, daven to the Rebbe.
How is that different than, I don't want to get too much into Lubavitch, but how is that so different than like the Christian point?
May or may not be. Anyway. I'm not really Lubavitch. I can't answer those questions. I study Hasidus. I know it's modern expressions or distortions or perversions, but it's important to me that when you see a Rebbe in full regal acting the role, ideally he's not just exploiting his Hasidim for some extra money or ruining their fish by putting his Rebbe hands on them. There's something very, very deep involved that you may choose not to practice, either because you're not into Kabbalah, or you're into Kabbalah, but not Hasidic Kabbalah. You could be a Mekubal and not be a Hasid. Don't just assume that every Mekubal is a Hasid. There are a lot of Mekubalim that are just not, they're Mekubal like the Vilna Gaon was a little bit, not like the Vilna Gaon, but in that pattern. So, you don't have to associate the two. Eitan.
Where do we make the jump from an experiential philosophical matter to actively affecting the cosmos? Like, what Kabbalah switch sides?
From
classic pedantic mysticism to actively affecting the world. They don't seem to be related so much.
Say the jump is, there are always two strains in Kabbalah. There's a passive contemplative mysticism, and there's an active redemptive, almost apocalyptic mysticism. I imagine that as the Gullus winds on, there's more of a emphasis on redemptive messiness, redemptive mysticism. This is a sense of we can take it out, so we take in chatzos and getting up and crying over the Beis HaMikdash. So for example, in a world that's more complete, if you lived in the first Beis HaMikdash or the second Beis HaMikdash, you were Mekubal, you just thought about how the world functioned. You knew the world was somewhat imperfect because it's a physical world, but you don't have this pressure to redeem the fallen world. Whereas once we're leaving the Gullus, I think that's where the beginnings of activist mysticism begin. But I think you only find its full fury is only reached 1,500 years later in Yitzchak Lurie. That's where Kabbalah was much more activist, tikkun chatzos, sense of geula, crying for the geula. I don't sense that, but I'm not a real expert, but I don't sense that so much. Sense in the Rashba, when you read the Rashba's Kabbalah, he's just describing the overall formula of Karbanos and what Kabbalistic elements they represent. It's like a sense to create a system of the world rather than to change the world. Yes, Josh.
Yeah, you mentioned because we're going through it, we don't have so much time, so we shouldn't work and study it. But why can't we simply make the time right shoe and if we tie the right shoe before the left shoe thing, that doesn't take so much time.
You can, for sure. I just feel this is an answer to Adir's question. Nothing wrong if you want to tie your left shoe before the right shoe. I just feel that to me it cheapens Kabbalah, and by extension it cheapens halacha when I do things that A, don't have any rational basis, B, aren't consistent within the system I operate within. I'm just importing something that doesn't fit my system. But in this case, the Shulchan Aruch writes it. So, for example, I have this, when I hear people saying Ho Chibah Netzach, Netzach Shibah Ho Tvers, to me these mean something, not something that I understand or practice. But I say what they mean is, see a guy who shoulders the Hojib Tiferes, nothing wrong. If you feel that there must be something here, and I'm going to say it during Sfiras Omer, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Are we required to follow
the
Shulchan Aruch on the other
issue,
or should we not?
Ask me, ask your Rebbe, ask your father, ask his Rebbe. Different strains. I think in Haredish circles, there's more of a sense of everything the Shulchan Aruch writes. See, you can argue with the Shulchan Aruch if the Shach argues with us, in this case, they're all like the Shach. What about when no one argues? And these Kabbalistic elements, no one really argues, it's just people saying that this is an element of Kabbalah we're not makbir. So there's a difference between passing like a Moshe Feinstein against the Shulchan Aruch and just, as it were, deleting a Shulchan Aruch. We have to be very careful. If they ask a Rebbe and say, is this something we'll keep, is this something we'll not makbir? Okay? I want to answer whatever the Moshe Feinstein wants. The whole thing is, it's not spooks, it's not boobs, it's not crazy, it's not off. It's something we don't practice. It's something that's deep, it's informed on Yisrael, it's a big chassid, it's saved on Yisrael, millions of people who have been lost on Yisrael. And I try to appreciate it, like you'd appreciate something that's true and part of our Masara. It's not something that we do.